Hi, this is Bob Rozakis. You're listening to the Batman Family Reunion on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Batman Family Reunion, a proud part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm Paul Kien, one of your hosts, and with me, as always, is my co-host and bat cousin, Sean M. Myers. What's new, Sean?
Well, I'm well, certainly better than our bat uncle Christian, who has a really sore throat.
Thanks, I'm doing pretty well too, but I was enjoying talking to Bat Uncle Ken, but he kept trying to convince me he was somebody else. I'm not sure what's going on with him. Anyway, this month we are super lucky to have two guests at the reunion. A first time to this show, but network founder and podcasting all-star, our Canadian bat cousin, Siskoid. And also our first three-time guest, that's right, Brett Young. How are you guys doing? And more importantly, what did you bring us to eat?
You know, like I don't need to do a guest spot on every show. I wasn't sure of the rules, the game. And when I heard Brett was going to be on this one, I knew I had to crash the barbecue, and crashing does not involve bringing.
Oh, okay.
Because he's been so entertaining in the past. I thought I could just sit at a picnic table, eat somebody else's potato salad, and pitch Brett some of my shows. I guess if you have to show up, you have to participate. Let me see what I can find in my pockets here.
All right. Oh, you know, maybe some of those old month-old Twinkies or something. That'd be good.
We don't have Twinkies in Canada. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. Sorry. So how about you, Brett? What did you bring this time?
Well, first of all, I am honored to be the first three-time guest. Sure, the others at the party are probably whispering at this point, when is this guy going to leave? Is he? So I brought some tasty cakes.
Oh,
because yeah. They are way better than that hostess nonsense. And of course, I brought a cocktail. So I thought, how about a Paloma? So very quickly, per drink, you want 2 ounces of tequila, 2 ounces of fresh grapefruit juice, 2 ounces of sparkling water, 1/2 ounce of lime juice, 1/4 ounce of simple syrup, some sea salt that are in the glass, and ice. Take a grapefruit wedge, rub it around the edge of the glass, then dip it in a small plate of the coarse sea salt. Then flip the glass over, pour in the tequila, grapefruit juice, sparkling water, lime juice, and the simple syrup. Stir in a glass, fill it with ice, garnish with a grapefruit wedge, and enjoy a nice summertime treat.
Now, you brought enough for all 75 people that are here, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. I just put a trash bag over one of the garbage pails around there, and I just stirred it with an old lacrosse stick.
Okay, guys, I found a couple of fuzzy lifesavers.
Oh, good.
Pocket treats are always the best.
This is good. We've had Brett on twice, so we know his history with the Batman family, but we'd love to hear your history. Did you buy the book when it came out or afterwards? Any favorite family members?
Yeah, well, before you started this show, I don't think I'd ever read an issue of Batman Family. So you got to understand that while we're all around the same age, being kind to some and maybe nasty to others, my first language isn't English. So my language skills had to catch up to the mediums. I've been reading comics since I was 3, like 1974, so that would place me. But they would be what people call Euro comics. So some American superhero stuff in really crappy black and white translations around age 9, I'd say. And who knows, there might have been some stories from Batman Family in there. Sometimes they just anthologized a bunch of things, random things. It was like Marvel, Charlton, and DC all scrunched together in these kind of fat books. So who knows? But I finally started buying comics in the very early 80s. So I missed Batman Family entirely. And even the Detective Dollar comics was way off my radar. In terms of who my favorite family members are, quite like Sean, but I guess you mean the Batman ones. So my Batman phase... If there really is such a thing as a Batman phase, it was probably the early 90s when the books flowed into one another, just like the Superman Triangle era, you know, those kinds of things, I suppose. We cover Brave and the Bold on FW Team Up. So those are some of my favorite Batman titles that I still read. But after the fact, obviously, as characters, I'm much more interested in Barbara Gordon and Dick Grayson than I am in Bruce Wayne, which makes the current Nightwing series a current favorite. Because they're both in there, and they say those two characters are the best family members over time, right into the current era.
Yeah, makes sense. It's not an uncommon answer. So, Sean, why don't you remind our listeners, for those who may be the first time they've heard this show, what our show is all about?
Batman Family was a DC comic that ran for 20 issues from 1975 to 1978, and then rescued Detective Comics from the DC implosion by continuing as a dollar comic for 15 more issues until 1980. The title started out with new features starring Batgirl and Robin, along with reprints, before morphing into all new stories starring other members of the Batman family, such as the Huntress, Commissioner Gordon, Man-Bat, and even Red Tornado and the Human Target. Both of your hosts collected and read these comics as they came out and are excited to share their love of this era at the Batman Family Reunion. Let's get into Detective Comics number 490, starring the Batman family.
Okay, so this issue is cover dated May 1980. Remember, we now are monthly. Detective was promoted to be the first dollar comic that was monthly, starting with last issue. It came out on February 28th, 1980. Still 64 pages for a dollar. We'll get into the page count and one of the letter writers later. I got a kick out of that. We've got five stories this time, and our cover was by Ross Andrew and Dick Giordano again. So, Siskoid, would you like to do the honors and give your sort of description of the cover, and then we can all give our 2 cents?
Sure, sure. I mean, this cover is under too much trade dress. We have a fight going on that's actually described in a caption, so I might as well read it. Ra's al Ghul, I'm sorry, I keep saying Ra's, but it's Ra's, right? Ra's al Ghul and Talia versus the Sensei and the Assassins, with Batman caught in the middle. So, Batman is doing a flying dance move. Yeah. There's a bat-like shadow under him. It's quite cool. And the Sensei is kicking towards him with both feet and missing. Talia has a gun with a silencer pointed at them. And Ra's is in the corner looking angry as he looks back towards us, or perhaps to his unseen assassins, all on a pale yellow background that contrasts with the thick emerald green border that announces plus new Robin and Batgirl solo epics. We don't all have the same definition of that last word. And now in his own series, Black Lightning. We'll see what you guys think, but I think it's just okay because all those graphics really hurt it, as usual, when they cut down the cover this way. What I hate the most is the Detective logo in this era. That dark purple cape that we have here around the logo, it just looks like someone took a marker to the cover and circled it. So it hurts the main image. If this was as big as the cover itself with fewer elements, I think we'd have a cool action cover with Batman popping in front of his logo that way.
Fair enough. Brett, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I like it. I like the figure work itself. I think it's kind of dynamic. I think it could have benefited from a little bit of background to sort of ground the art, because it almost looks like it's four separate things that are sort of layered on the page, almost like color forms or something like that. Like Siskoid said, it's not bad. It's not one of their finest.
John?
I think this is the worst cover of the entire run.
Wow.
I kind of think it's horrible. Other than the Sensei, I think everything else on this cover is atrocious. The green and the yellow, I hate that. That purple of Batman's cape, I hate that. The Black Lightning colors, they should have thrown blue in there because of his outfit. I certainly love dancing, but I think Batman looks like he's dancing. I think he looks like he's one of the Rockettes, and I love the Rockettes. Talia, I think the figure of Talia is okay. I hate her outfit. She's just wearing a bathing suit kind of thing. Yeah, I hate that. Ra's al Ghul.
What is he doing?
Swatting a fly, maybe.
This is a deep cut, and I guess we'll include it in the gallery, but do you guys remember the Neil Adams public service announcement with Superman? Some little kid is in the corner.
Yes.
Come on. Like, that kind of reminds me of that. And I don't like the way that kid looks. I think that's a horrible representation of him. It's just, I just, wow.
What's Sebastian Shaw doing there?
Yeah. Yes, he does look like Sebastian Shaw. Certainly Batman and the Sensei and Talia, in my opinion, they're on model. I don't like Batman's positioning. I mean, Ross Andrew always likes limbs flying all over the place, right? So I think that's what he's doing. Yeah, I agree. It looks a little dancing. It just suffers from too much. And if he just had the Sensei and Batman fighting, make them bigger, get rid of some of the trade dress, all that stuff. The green, while not my favorite, I'm going to mildly disagree. I think it pops on the stands. You don't see a lot of comics with this color as the background. So I don't mind that so much. But other than that, you're like, what the heck is going on here? So I guess in that regard, it's done its job.
We will post the image of this cover as well as some additional pages from each of the stories in our family portrait gallery on the network's website. Paul, remind our listeners where that is.
That is fireandwaterpodcast.com. So let's jump into that first story. That is starring Batman, of course, entitled Requiem for a Martyr. It's a 22-pager by Denny O'Neill and Don Newton, with inks by Dan Atkins, of course. And it has been reprinted in Tales of the Batman in Don Newton hardcover, but also in the Tales of the Demon trade paperback from way back in 1991, and the hardcover from more recently in 2020 collects the whole starting Ra's al Ghul through this League of Assassins storyline. So we start our story as Batman breaks up an explosive smuggling operation being conducted at the docks by the League of Assassins. These guys don't pose much of a threat to Batman, though. He clears them all out pretty easily, including a guy with a butcher's hook. even insults them, saying he knows they're just Sensei's laborers and not assassins. But then Bruce gets a little more of a workout when he is surprised by Lurk, who is a big tough guy for Ra's al Ghul, basically a substitute Ubu. After a fun Don Newton fight, Batman puts Lurk in his place with a Captain Kirk double-fisted shot to the head. Batman then discovers that Lurk's mission had actually been the same as his, to stop the Sensei's men from unloading the explosives. But the big guy couldn't resist taking a shot at Batman, which allowed the League's men to escape with those explosives. We then know for sure that this is the Bronze Age Batman for two reasons. One, he hops on his whirly bat to go home. And two, he admits he actually needs help to help defeat the Sensei. That help? Baron McManus. Who's that? Well, he's the geologist that Batman saved from the Sensei's men last issue. You know, the bingo guy. So Batman brings a blindfolded McManus to the Batcave. Ah, another Bronze Age goodie. McManus uses his Apple Pencil to draw Gotham City's geological fault line on Batman's computer map. They discuss what would happen if explosives were set off near the fault line. Batman realizes that the Sensei wanted to create an earthquake severe enough to destroy an estate near Gotham, where a peace conference with world religious leaders is going on. Batman rushes to the ideal spot and finds the punks there burying the explosives. But he's too late to stop them from burying it, and now he has only 30 minutes left to save the peace delegates. To the whirly bat. We cut to the peace conference. Commissioner Gordon is personally supervising security for the conference. Despite his men telling him that the approaching whirly bat looks like Batman, the commish says he can't take any chances and tells him to shoot it down. Maybe this is the spook still masquerading as Jim? I don't know. Batman has to battle past three pages of Newton action against cops to get to the conference where he tells everybody to evacuate. One of the attendees refuses to go, and an exasperated Batman stalks out of the mansion. But once outside, he's confronted by the Sensei, who had disguised himself as one of the other attendees and is now holding them all hostage with a gun. He's holding them all there, waiting for the earthquake to come and kill them all. When Batman reminds him he will die too, he says, "A small price to pay for witnessing my greatest work of art, for I am an artist of death." Batman tells him he is a loony, and at least Ra's al Ghul wants to take control and use the League of Assassins in a, quote, practical way. Good for Ra's. Sensei shoots the delegate, who come out of the house and heads back to the mansion. Batman tells Gordon to get the delegates out of there, and he's about to go into the house after Sensei. He tells the victim, "I guess we're really no different. We are both willing to die for our principles. I vowed that the Sensei will not go unpunished, and I'll die for that vow if I must." But then, who shows up but Ra's al Ghul and Talia? Ra's tries to tell Batman that he has opposed Sensei since the beginning, so he will go after him, and Batman can escape. Batman says, "No thanks. I'm still not convinced that it wasn't you who endangered Kathy in the first place," which it was, so come on, Denny. Anyway, the argument is cut short as Talia fires a dart with a sleeping toxin and knocks out Batman. The house is destroyed, apparently killing both Sensei and Ra's. We cut to the next morning as Batman awakens in full cowl and costume, but no cape, to the tender ministrations of Talia. They go for a stroll in the dawn sunlight, and Batman says, "You know, maybe I could take a morning off." Whew! The end of Denny's Ra's al Ghul epic. What did you guys think? Let's start with you, Siskoid.
Well, we really didn't get the martial arts brawl we were promised on the cover.
No.
Martial arts brawl slash dance competition, whatever it is. So you think you can dance a disco competition? We didn't get that. But I think Assassination by Earthquake is a pretty worthy plot. Even though I think a geologist would take issue with this idea of a fault line on the North American East Coast.
Right through Gotham City.
Gotham City did suffer a big earthquake in the 90s, didn't it?
There yes, like, they did.
Yeah.
Yeah. The cataclysm.
Exactly, cataclysm. So the DCU is, let's say, different from our world, geologically speaking, because that probably doesn't make sense. But one of the things that I did like was how the Sensei fight disappoints. But all the other fights, it's just against normal guys. He fights Teamsters and construction workers. But each of these fights has its little twists, and it makes it dynamic and interesting, even though you'd think those people would be outmatched against Batman. So carrying us through the story, there's some fun action beats. It just seems like we ran out of space at the end.
How about you, Brett? What are your initial thoughts?
I really enjoyed this. It almost reminded me of a Nicolas Cage 90s action movie, you know, where it's just sort of ridiculous stuff after ridiculous stuff happening. I thought the fight choreography, even though there wasn't a lot of martial arts, so to speak, I thought the fight choreography in a lot of places was good. You guys know I love Don Newton. I love his art, characters. Everybody looks different. I think it's great. So I really enjoyed this one.
Sean, what are your 2 cents?
I think it's a tale of two tales. So I think it would have worked better just as a story about these religious leaders meeting and someone plotting against. That part, I think, is great. As a conclusion to this multi-epic that started off with the death of a beloved superheroine, it just falls flat and is not satisfying. I do think it's great that the sensei is a huge fan of the first Superman movie, so much so that he uses Lex Luthor's plot device
right
in this. I like that. And yeah, the artwork's fantastic. The fights are great. Those story beats I like, but I don't like that it's part of this Vengeance Vow thing.
I agree. I mean, the art's great throughout. We'll walk through it. I kind of agree what you guys are saying. It does wrap up the plot points, which is good. Again, not all of them satisfactory. The way you say, Sean, I totally agree with that. But there's a bit to be desired from a motivation. It just felt like Denny was trying to craft this big, humongous, sprawling storyline, and it just got out of hand, and he didn't know how to, and he's just trying to finish it. Let's walk through. So we start off with the scene at the docks. Batman insults these guys, like, you guys aren't even assassins. I'll take care of you. What did you guys think of this scene?
Great looking goons. You have Sipowicz with the striped shirt and the meat hook there. Yeah, the guy, I guess, who's in charge, who's supposed to just keep a lookout wearing the suit. I thought it was really cool.
I love on the first page, we know that what they're carrying, because it's labeled right on the top. Danger.
They're really great at smuggling. I see that it's Praying, the company. Yeah. Name check that artist. Yeah, Don Newton does a really good job. To me, he's kind of the precursor to Alan Davis, right? Yeah. His figures really look like that. And if one is a fan favorite, the other should be as well. Really great action choreography. That's what I meant. It's like all those little fights at the beginning are all pretty cool. They've got interesting antagonists. You know, then the big beefy guy comes in, and Ra's guy, and then screws up. All of these fights have memorable beats. It's just, we'll see at the end, the sensei is kind of taken out or not out too easily compared to these guys.
Yeah. I like page 3, especially, I don't know about you guys, but you've got Batman taking on Lurk. He gets Batman in a hold, and Batman gives him the elbow back to the gut, and then the fist up, and steps on his toe. I thought all that stuff was great.
And I've never known Batman to be so chatty. He talks a lot in this issue, which brings up the only mistake I was able to find in the issue. On page 2, the first panel where he's on top of the van in front of the Sprang building.
Yes, I love the Sprang building.
Oh, I didn't even notice that. That's great.
It says, gave us both some trouble. Put down your weapons and surrender. It's supposed to be save, but it's a G. There's no connecting line on that top loop.
You know, it almost looks like they replaced the S with a G. The line of it, if you really look close at the font, maybe the S fell off and somebody at the last minute put a G, thinking it was a G. That's weird.
Yeah, but what if you read it backwards? Does it make sense that way?
And it's good to know the League of Assassins is just like any other organization out there. They need people to unload trucks, do coffee runs. You know, everybody's not an assassin, although they all came to play.
Well, there's your next story. League of Assassins, middle management.
Kind of a lower decks. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
And I do like they tie it into the story from the Batman Spectacular.
Yes, that was cool.
Although I don't remember that being Lurk. But it's nice that they talk about that.
Nowadays, correct me if I'm wrong, guys, but I think they say Ubu has been many different big guys. I don't know if he's clones or what, but many different. And so they've given up Ra's having, because I think Ubu died at one point, but now they just substitute Ubu's come left and right. So I think they've given up on Lurk. What did you guys think of Lurk talking about how he couldn't help himself? The question was, Lurk really acting against Ra's wishes? And this is part of the motivation stuff. Maybe we're not meant to know, but is he just trying to fake Batman out? Think of that at all, or did you take him at face value?
I took it at face value.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, was he there just to kind of make sure that Batman was involved and then report back to Ra's, maybe?
He said he was there to stop the explosives because Ra's wanted to stop the assassination attempt on the delegates.
Right.
Right.
Oh,
he says that. And then he says, I got too excited. I saw Batman who I want to get back at. So I'm going to go after Batman. And
he's not going to go against his orders.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Does a kind of guy working his muscle for Ra's al Ghul go against his orders? I know he's not the sharpest knife in the shed, but still. Anyway, so then we cut to the delegates, and you've got the one delegate saying, get rid of all the armed protection because I don't believe in any violence whatsoever, which will come back later. I think that was the purpose of that scene, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. I don't know if we want to open this philosophical debate, but just because one person is against the whatever violence of these guns, what about everyone else in the room? Maybe they would feel better if they were protected. Bat cousins, yeah. You can philosophize what you want.
Well, I also think we can talk about it now. Does not wanting to have weapons anywhere near you, which I can understand that as a philosophy, mean that you wouldn't evacuate the building later?
Right.
Yeah.
That linkage didn't make sense to me. I mean, I know I jumped ahead. So then we jumped to the Batcave, and now we know what the geologist was for. Nowadays, Batman would just know this.
Yeah. That's true.
You would know about all geology, but this time he's got to get the guy. And I thought that scene was a good way to clue the reader in on what the bad guy's plot was, what they were trying to do.
By the way, I did some quick live Google search. As far as fault lines in the East Coast, there is a big fault line that actually runs through New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. It's like 185 miles long.
Oh, how about that? Well, you know,
there you go.
We did have a tremor not too long ago. We did have an earthquake
a couple months ago.
Yeah, we had one occasion. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So there you go. So then Batman goes after the guys. Why does he dress up in the hard hat?
To find out if they've already put the explosive.
So they would truthfully answer him, I guess.
I like that part of it, that he's just in a trench coat and a hat, and they think, oh, well, he's one of us. I like that.
Yeah, it's cool, but it is neat. I do like it when these stories where Batman can be foiled, you know, he wants to stop the explosives from being buried and he's too late, right? Yeah, so I do like that. And the art on pages 10 and 11, I think, were really good. I like him using the shovel and the other guy coming after him with a pickaxe, and that's all good stuff.
It's the slowest stick of dynamite throw ever. It takes like four panels for this thing to land.
He lobbed it. There used to be a time when I was collecting instances of what I called battle shovel action. Because it happened in a role-playing game or something that I was playing in, they became the Order of the Shovel. And then I was just sending my players these battle shovel moments from movies, TV, and comics, whenever. So I think I'm probably going to snap a picture here and send them this as a nostalgia.
What's your favorite kind of shovel?
I don't know enough about shovels. There's shoveling shovels, and then there's battle shovels. And of course, snow shovels are kind of different than these are spades.
Yeah.
So I think a spade is probably more dangerous than a snow shovel, which is what I have.
Yeah.
But the snow shovel you can use to block. I think that would be a better
shield,
defensive shovel. Yeah. And then hit him with the sides of it because it has kind of the sharp.
Okay. Oh, you mean the long one, the scraper?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Maybe that one would have some power, but most shovels, they have the plastic scoop. I've broken enough of those to know that I wouldn't go into battle with them.
Yeah.
Well, that'll be continued next month on
Shovelcast,
the new podcast on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Back to Batman, hops on his whirly bat, and then we cut to Gordon. So this was the part I just shook my head at. Gordon is shoot it down, even if it is Batman, which if it was somebody else.
Yeah. Because it says it looks like the Batman's.
Right.
Well, we can't take any chances. I think we could take this one chance.
No, I kind of agree, because theoretically, you could see a villain just having some copter that looks like slap scalloped wings on anything, and it looks like the Batman owns it.
I hear you, but I just think they specifically had Gordon, and if it was somebody else, if it was Bullock around yet? Maybe not. But if it was somebody else, I could see this no problem, but Gordon would think he'd get a pair of binoculars out and go look for himself. I don't know. It bugged me. That's all.
And the cops in the copter can't tell?
Who else has a whirly bat?
We'll no-prize it by saying Gordon was thinking, well, if Batman's going to come in as whirly bat, he would have let me know.
And look how cloudy it is. It's dark. Yeah. It's cloudy. They're on edge.
Yeah. All right.
The branding failed.
All right. Fair enough. So Batman shows up. He's in angry Batman mode, yelling at Gordon once again. Then he's got his mean Batman. And then the one guy says, I'm not going to leave. I'm not going to succumb to threats or force. In short, I refuse to go. I loved the little three panels at the top of 17.
He's exasperated.
Batman's like, dude, I've had it with you. I've had a bad night.
One thing about those three panels, and Sisko alluded to it earlier, that Alan Davis probably took a lot of inspiration from him. That second image looks like an Alan Davis
drawing.
And the third one actually kind of looks like a John Byrne drawing, I thought.
Yeah,
I thought Byrne and Davis have some similarities. Yeah. But backing up a little bit, the first panel on page 15, where he's crashing through the stone wall, I thought was awesome. Yeah, I thought that was a gorgeous picture. Good. I wish that would have been a full frame. That's a great picture.
And let me track back another page, giving some reasonableness to the priest who doesn't want to leave the house. Out there, the cops are shooting missiles at the estate.
Right? That is too funny.
And also, Batman doesn't really talk about the earthquake. It's just like, evacuate, get out of here. So the communication is key. If the priest thinks he can make a stand inside the house against, I don't know, assassins, gunmen, this is going to be an earthquake. But they're not told this.
Yeah, that's an excellent point.
A bit of the blame falls on Batman for poor communication skills, which he's been known for in the past.
He's just yelling at them all and saying, you just do what I tell you to do, which we've seen Denny do a lot of. Sean, I found a typo. Page 18.
Oh, wait. So I literally just noticed on page 16, the first panel with all the religious delegates. It's nice that Uncle Dudley Marvel was included with the group.
So look at the top first panel of page 18.
Oh, you're about to die with the rest of us.
Batman says to Sensei, don't you realize you're, and it's spelled Y-O-U-R instead of apostrophe R-E.
Yes.
Brenda Pope cannot get to DC fast enough. So then the rather underwhelming fight scene, this is where I thought it felt rushed. I agree with who said it felt rushed between Batman and Sensei. Sensei, has he used a gun before? I felt that was a little out of character. But I guess how else is he going to stop them from all going at once to stay at the earthquake place? He hits Sensei, but not strong enough. And Sensei runs back into the building. Batman tells him to go and yells at Gordon again.
Yeah, he really emasculates Gordon there, doesn't he?
Yeah. Will you please stop arguing with me?
Bill, not the word earthquake. And I'm not even sure that Sensei's plan is that clever. He says, I replaced the Japanese delegate, Reverend Agura. Clever of me, was it not, to disguise myself as an Asian?
Yes. Yeah.
Translated it for today. Yeah. When we get to 70s stuff. But is it? It's something you would say if you would never have thought that I would do this, that an Asian man might impersonate another Asian man. It's not that as clever as you think. It's not even a martial arts punch. He gets a punch in the jaw, Batman beating up a senior, and then he runs off and it's over. Yeah. It's like,
that was disappointing.
Well, plus everybody bugs out and they just leave the priest dead on the sidewalk. Nobody even checks this guy. Batman starts monologuing over his body.
You want it to be a murder? You're a murder.
Each of them have figured he has gone on to where each of them believe that he will go on to.
Maybe.
But at least check a pulse and turn him over and see if nobody even looks at him.
So then Batman confronts Ra's al Ghul, a lot of back and forth there, and Talia's shoots him from behind. Page 20 we're on now. I know, I could have seen that coming. I don't know why Roz thinks he has to, if Roz wants control, again, I get back to motivations. What's Roz really trying to do, right? Roz wants control of the League of Assassins. We know that much. And so he's got to kill Sensei to do it. So why doesn't he just let him die in the earthquake building? I don't know. I don't get why Roz had to run in other than to fake his own death, which maybe that's what he was thinking.
Maybe.
I think he's also getting Batman, isn't he? They're coming to get Batman, who is his chosen heir.
Yeah.
And I think maybe if we want to give a reason for Lurk showing up and maybe lying about why he's there, they need to make sure that Sensei goes about his plan. Mm. If they don't have the explosives, they don't create the earthquake, Sensei doesn't show his hand, doesn't show up at that mansion.
Mm.
So he needs Sensei to show up at the mansion, where he will double cross him in some way, or
I like that.
Well, not that the story says this, but
I like it. We're all about our own stories in our own heads here. You know?
Yeah, we're gonna come in. We're gonna save Batman from himself because he's in the middle of a monologue as the earthquake is coming, and they hope that Sensei will—he's run into the house that he'll be dead in the house, but we have to leave before the earthquake hits with Batman.
Which is what happens. And he's setting him and Talia for a little romantic adventure coming up. So I kind of like it. I like that explanation.
But again, Batman gets shot in the back and then falls on the dead priest too. So another indignity for this guy. Not only does nobody even check him, but then Batman like lands right on him.
He does.
And if he wasn't already dead.
Yeah, that did it. Yeah.
So then we get a whole page of the building collapsing, which I thought was weird.
Yeah.
Well, no, you do see it's like the explosion and then the crack is coming down the mountain.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. And then it hits the house and then there's rubble. So I like this sequence.
All right. Fair enough. And then we get to the last page where Batman wakes up and, you know, Talia knows the secret identity. Like, why is his mask still on? That's just silly.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe she likes it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that could be.
I understand that.
How many of these stories have him? It's like he's bare chested, but he's got the cowl.
Yeah.
You know,
that's just true.
Yeah.
I kind of ship these two. I much prefer Talia to Catwoman or some of his others. I think it's nice. She's sort of the exotic Bond girl and has evolved the same way Bond girls have evolved. They used to be just a helpless victim love interest, and now they have their own thing going on. And the whole thing with Roz being the evil father that's also Batman's enemy, Thanksgiving would be weird, but I think they work well together. And I like it so much better. I hate the Bat-Cat thing. I definitely prefer Batman with Talia.
I don't disagree, you know.
He's got the nice cottage. You know, spend a week there. Do some fishing.
I was thinking about this yesterday. I really love Silver St. Cloud.
Sure. She was great.
Yeah, I think she's my favorite. Yeah. Although that's more Bruce. And maybe that's because it's that story and that
part. Yeah. She has the advantage of being in a much more limited number of stories.
Right, yeah.
And they made Talia super evil for a while there, which turned me off. She's got to have some semblance of good. Like, you can accept Catwoman when she's somewhat good and protecting her section of Gotham City and, you know, only stealing from the super rich people. You know, Batman can turn his blind eye to that. When she's supporting her father in his plan to exterminate 90% of the people, it's kind of hard to...
And it gave us Damien.
It did give us Damien, much to other members.
Yeah.
For some people.
This is either a good or a bad thing, depending on who you are.
Yeah, that's true.
I like it. I'm good with it.
All right, fair enough. Any final thoughts on this story? Are we ready to move on?
No, unless you guys want to talk about shovels.
But watch for the dialogue in other stories. There's two instances in this one of someone saying, "How dare you?" Including Batman. And it happens again later in the issue. Someone says, "How dare you?"
Oh, okay.
So right now, though, we're going to move on to the Bat timeline, where we're going to take a look at the other titles that were published this month and what the Batman family and other members of the DC and Marvel universes were doing. As always, thanks to Mike's Amazing World of DC Comics. This is, again, as we mentioned earlier, February 1980, and we start off with the Bat books. So the first one is Batman number 323 with a great Dick Giordano cover. You've got the return of Catwoman. This whole Len Wein, Irv Novik time in the Batman title is among my favorites. I really love this cover. Catwoman is jumping at Batman with a shadow of a... Usually we always see the shadow of the bat around. Here we got the shadow of a cat coming at her, so I love that.
Moving on to The Brave and the Bold, number 162, and it is Batman and Sergeant Rock. And it's a World War II battle blockbuster featuring the deadly Iron Major.
All right. And then likewise, we have DC Comics Presents number 21 is Superman teaming up with Elongated Man. Well, I was debating whether or not to count that as Batman Family, but he has appeared in Batman Family, so I thought I'd mention it. We also get Justice League number 178, and it's got a really cool Jim Starlin cover. It's sort of a play on the Despero playing chess cover from Justice League number one, where you've got Despero playing chess against John Jones, and the Justice League members are inside little cases where they're moving them about on the chessboard. Pretty neat. Of course, inside it's by Jerry Conway and Dick Dillon.
I love anytime there's chess pieces and stuff that the villains use. I'm such a sucker for that.
Gives them a good chance to monologue. Yes, it gives them a good chance to monologue.
Yeah, just move them around. It's fantastic.
And, you know, with the visual medium that is comics, what better to use than the fast-paced action game of chess?
Yeah.
Well, but I would argue chess is a visual game because you have the board, you have the pieces.
I know, I'm just teasing.
Batman and Robin and former villain Scarecrow appear in Super Friends number 32. It's a great cover because Scarecrow is right in the middle and all the Super Friends are around him cowering in fear. That's fantastic. Normally we talk about World's Finest, but there's none this month because Detective has gone monthly for now. Siskoid, let's go with what you are picking off of the newsstand.
I mean, the only thing I have in here, originally I wasn't buying comics at this point, so I have a complete run of ROM, Space Knight.
All right.
So issue 6 here is the only one I actually have physically. So what would I pick up? Obviously the two team-up books you mentioned, plus Marvel Team-Up and Marvel 2-in-1. I guess I'm otherwise completing some collections. Legion of Superheroes number 263. FF 218, which has early FF art by John Byrne before his actual run, written by Bill Mantlo, a favorite of mine. Savage She-Hulk number 4, can't resist. And Wonder Woman 267 has Animal Man in it.
Animal Man!
I normally would have picked up Daredevil and Avengers, maybe Defenders and JLA if I have extra pocket change. For resale value, I'm going back in time, my time machine. When Guardians of the Galaxy comes out, I would want to resell Marvel Spotlight number 6, which seems to introduce Star-Lord. Yes. I do not recommend those Marvel Star Trek comics. And I'm suddenly in the UK. Okay, I'll buy those 4 Doctor Who weeklies.
I'm going to take you back to that Wonder Woman. I actually looked it up. You got Animal Man in there, which I thought was great. And apparently this was Animal Man's first appearance since Strange Adventures number 201 in 1967. So 13-year gap. And then Animal Man had only 5 appearances before this in Strange Adventures. This two-parter, the Forgotten Heroes issue of DC Comics Presents, and then a cameo in Red Tornado number 3 of all places. And that was it. Pre-Crisis, pre-Grant Morrison. You know, I'm always amazed to find out that these characters that we think of as having a long history really didn't, especially pre-Crisis.
Really was a forgotten hero.
Yes, he was. Yeah. How about you, Brett?
Oh, you know, I always have a bunch. Amazing Adventures 6. I had a bunch of those. Love the old X-Men, the original X-Men stories. Mm-hmm. Avengers 195. I think Perez is probably one of the low-key best Ant-Man artists ever.
Oh, yeah.
He's had some really cool covers using Ant-Man.
You know what happens in this issue, right? The last panel has a cameo first appearance of Taskmaster.
Oh, does it?
Yep. In this issue right here. Yep.
Best of DC 5, which is, I think, the one we talk about later, right?
Yes.
Okay. Fantastic Four 218. I had this issue. If I'm remembering this issue correctly, this guy's called the Trapster or something. He used to be Paste Pot Pete.
Yes.
And this is where he changes his name, and there's a bunch of jokes about his name or something. I had that Hulk issue, too. I love the cover for Jonah Hex. 36. It's a great cliffhanger cover.
Yeah, that is a great cover.
Framing with the river underneath it. And he was smart enough to outline the river around the figures enough so the woman's dark hair wouldn't overlap with the dark rocks, too. I thought that was a nice touch. Legion Superheroes. I have all the Legion stories. The Man-Thing 4. That was a cool cover with Doctor Strange. I agree with Siskoid on Marvel Spotlight. Marvel Super Action. Love the old Avengers stories.
And that one has the origin of the Vision. I had that one on my list.
Yeah. Marvel Team Up 93. I thought that was kind of a creepy, cool cover. Marvel 2 and 163 as Perez. So, of course, I got that one. Micronauts. Batman Family Legend. Michael Golden in that. And Chaykin does the interiors, which is crazy. Star Wars, because you have Vader. Are playing with chess pieces. You gotta have it. He's got the heroes as chess pieces. Fantastic. Love that cover. And of course, Superman Family 201. That's Sean's next podcast. And then finally, X-Men 133. Probably the first iconic Wolverine story, I think, where he gets dropped into the sewers during the Hellfire battle and everything, where he kind of has the solo part of the adventure. So, great story.
Sean, you got any left?
Yes. So, normally I go in alphabetical order, but I'm going to skip around a little bit. Action Comics number 507. That was the two-parter with the return of Jonathan Kent. And that is a fantastic story. Adventure Comics 471, back when it was Plastic Man and Starman. I recently had a work conference that I had to go to, and I knew that there would be nights in the hotel. So I took that adventure run and read all of Starman, which it's good. It's like, okay, good. The royalty subplot is actually really, really interesting. I think the Starman costume is fantastic, and it's worth a read, but...
It's not a classic, but it was enjoyable. I mean, I hear you. Okay, good. I'm glad you got a chance to read it.
I would be curious about Battle of the Planets number 6, but it's from Gold Key, so it's probably crappy. Marvel Fun and Games number 9, which is a wonderful, fantastic issue, which I have it right here in my hands. The New Adventures of Superboy number 5, because I loved that title. I always thought that was great. Spider-Man number 26 has a fantastic cover, where there's like a buzzsaw going right for Spider-Woman. Spidey Super Stories number 46 with Mysterio on the cover. I love Mysterio. I actually love that costume, that character, that vision. The next one is a double digest spectacular. The Best of DC Digest number 5, which is the year's best comic stories. And DC Special Digest number 2, which is The Flash and His Friends. You guys know that I love the digest. This, I think, is probably my favorite month of digests ever. I love both issues. It was the first year's best comic stories. It's fantastic because they have the cover with all the heroes at the Academy Awards, and I love that.
You'll be proud of me, Sean. I had very few digests. That was one I actually had.
And look, if Dead Man's going to wear that cowl, tell him to sit in the back.
Right. Yeah, just like that woman at the Academy Awards.
Yeah. See, Hawkman was nice enough to sit in the back. Yep.
No, the great thing is he doesn't block any vision because they can't see him. It's just an empty seat. Yeah. And I will be telling a story about the Flash Digest later on in the episode.
I just have a couple things to add. Amazing Spider-Man I bought every month. This was the last Marv Wolfman issue before he came to DC. He had a couple other stories published after this in other Marvel comics, but this is his last Amazing Spider-Man. And then I wanted to pull out, because it's been on the alternate months, and now that we're monthly, All Out War number 5. I'm not a big war comic guy, but I was at a show, I don't know, 7, 8 years ago, and somebody had, there's only 6 issues of this for $1 a piece. So I bought all 6 and read them. And what I really dug was the Viking Commando. So here was a Viking warrior who was frozen in suspended animation and came out. It was really a good story. But I reminded, because I recently did JLU cast with the Franklins, it's a very similar storyline to the Viking Prince that they brought back in Sergeant Rock, where he was in suspended animation and wanted to find his way to Valhalla. And then the only one other that I had that I want to mention is Green Lantern 218. It's a really striking cover, I thought, of half of Green Lantern and half of Hector Hammond, and he's trying to take over Hal's mind. That's a tough to convey concept, but I thought you get it from this cover. And again, that's by Master Dick Giordano. Those are what I had.
And then to round it out, of course, we do our Richie Rich count. It's a little slow month for Richie because he has only 9 titles, only 9. But one of them is Richie Rich Millions number 100.
Wow.
100th issue of that.
I probably had them all. That's how I learned to read English. I had an aunt who would buy every Richie Rich and Archie on the stands. When she was done with them, like bathroom readers, I guess, she would bring these bundles. She would like tie them together with string and bring us these bundles, which were about half my height.
That's
awesome.
Tall kid. And this was around this era, like 3rd grade, 4th grade. I was learning to read English basically through these books.
That's awesome.
But I lost them all. We got rid of them in a move at some point.
Well, these guys have been begging for somebody to do a Richie Rich podcast. I think you found your next venture.
Oh, yeah. My next venture. Yeah.
Okay, we are going to move on to our second story. And that second story is Dance of Death, starring Batgirl. It's 8 pages, written by Mike W. Barr, penciled by John Cownan, inked by Joe Gila, and it was reprinted in Batgirl, The Bronze Age Omnibus, Volume 2, hardcover from 2019. Batgirl in Dance of Death. The first thing that Batgirl does in this story is stop a sniper from killing her father's houseguest, renowned danseur Charles Ray. After the sniper gets away, Babs goes back into the house and finds out that Charles has been receiving death threats. Charles's son Philippe arrives, and as Batgirl eavesdrops on the conversation, we learn that Philippe is upset that his father Charles has scheduled himself to be the premier danseur étoile. I don't know if I'm saying that right.
Not bad.
Maybe there's someone who speaks French on this podcast who can help me out.
It's not bad. Danseur étoile.
For tomorrow's night show, believing that a dancer of his age will make the dance company look bad. In order to protect Charles, Babs Christopher chances herself onto the ballet scene as an exerciser. She doesn't have to wait for long before a bomb is delivered to Charles, which she handily throws out the window. She slips back into her disguise just in time to hear Charles arguing with his daughter, Cecile. Cecile's unresolved issue is that on the night that she was born, her dad really believed in the phrase, "the show must go on," and ignored her mother as she was dying of pneumonia. Now, Bat Cousins, I wrote that paragraph thinking that it was true, and then I went back and reread it, and there's no mention that she died on the night she was born, so I don't know why I like had that in my mind, and I was going to go back and change it up. I thought, no, I'll do that. Charles tells her that he'll turn things around after tomorrow's announcement, to which Cecile says a line only heard in murder mystery stories, "Nothing could change my mind, father, not even your death." Our story jumps ahead to opening night of the ballet, where before they are on stage, Philippe and Cecile are drinking water. Batgirl overhears Cecile say that the American water tastes bad in such a natural, matter-of-fact, not at all clunky dialogue, which is probably in no way a clue as to what's going to happen. The performance goes off without a hitch, but at the end, as the prima ballerina receives a bouquet of flowers that did not come from the Sherwood florist, Batgirl notices that the yellow roses in the bouquet are discolored, and that can happen when roses are exposed to poison gas. Batgirl deduces that Philippe protected both him and his sister from the gas, but not his father, and that he, Philippe, has been the one trying to kill his father. After a pas de deux dance fight, Batgirl subdues Philippe, and Charles needs to twist the knife just a little bit by saying that if Philippe would have waited, he would have found out that tonight is the night that Charles was going to announce his retirement. What did you guys think? We'll start with Brett.
Dance fight.
Finally.
The messy family. This one's kind of dumb.
This is the promise of the cover, the dance fight.
Right. Yes, exactly. It's not great. The art doesn't help either. It's got some fun sort of silly slash stupid parts to it.
How about you, Cisco?
Art-wise, it feels a lot like a Superman family story because half of the issue, Batgirl is kind of in Lois Lane cosplay. Oh, panel by panel, I covered just one panel of a story that kind of felt like this, but it was roller skating instead of dancing.
Ooh, yeah.
It was like a roller derby mystery. But it's Mike Barr, so you get your mystery. It's short, so you don't have a lot of suspects. It's either one or the other.
Right.
And then little twist at the end, a little ironic twist at the end. Again, communication is key. If you told your kids what you were planning, having to do it on stage.
Yeah, he couldn't have just said, guys, chill out. Yeah. I just want to have one last blaze of glory, then it's all yours. He couldn't have possibly have taken 10 seconds to say that.
No, that's the problem here. But I mean, it's an ordinary story.
Yes. Pedestrian was the word I have written down.
Pedestrian is
pedestrian.
Good. Good word.
I mean, it's not a bad plot overall, but it's just the execution is pedestrian. So that's my main point.
I know we don't do this, but this is my story of the issue. This is the one I liked the most. Even I'm not saying that means that it's a great story. I just think the other stories aren't great in this issue. But this is the one I like the most. Obviously, I love that Barbara Gordon does her Christopher. Now, I know she's not going specifically as someone, but she is going undercover. We can go beat by beat if you want. I don't know if the story warrants that. I do love the opening. It opens with an action scene of her stopping the assassin.
I wanted to ask Brett what he thought here again of
my God,
Commissioner Gordon's house. Did you note that he had a maid?
Yes, I was going to bring. I was going to bring that
he
up.
He has a maid to receive visitors.
Well, commissioner is a big deal, isn't it?
This is the dirtiest Gordon I've ever seen. He's clearly on the take.
But the commissioner would have money, right? That's a high-paying job, commissioner.
But if anything, instead of a maid, maybe they should have had police bodyguard or something like that.
Yeah, maybe.
That would make more sense, I think.
I will say that the French in this, they make one mistake, and it's that Philippe is not written this way. It's got two P's, just like Philip has two L's in English. So that, but there's a lot more French than usual. Isn't there a zut alors? I hate that stuff. Nobody says that. But
zut alors.
Zut alors. If it's not here, it's another story.
I think it's in Black Lightning, yeah.
I had the Black Lightning as zut alors, you're right. That's even worse because a Haitian says it. That makes zero sense. But there's a lot of French phrases here and there, and they don't screw up the grammar and they don't screw up the spelling, which is surprising. So good job, Mike Barr, or whoever proofread these elements. So I was surprised about that. One of the things that I still can't get over is the comic calling Batgirl the dominoed dare doll. They were really thirsty for alliteration on that one. And they say it twice.
And it's in the header, too. And did you know, Sean, proofreader, you read it backwards, you'd realize that they still call her a congresswoman in the header of the story.
Oh, yeah.
And she no longer is, right?
That's right. She's lost the election. Yeah. She's back in Gotham. My favorite part of this was top of page 3 where Babs looks like a teeny bopper. She's listening in on her dad like she used to do when Batman came over. That I liked. That I thought was cute.
She's got a little teddy bear. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the son telling him he's 45 years old is too old. Screw you, Philippe.
Well, for a ballet dancer, maybe.
And this is super getting into the semantics. I think it would depend on how big of a deal Charles is. Because if Charles is this huge mega superstar.
He's a big name, yeah.
It kind of wouldn't matter because they would change some of the routine
choreography,
stuff like that. Exactly. Right. Yeah. You know, like, and I know it's a little bit different. Sinatra was singing into the 80s, singing off of a teleprompter, but nobody cared because it was Sinatra. So, I mean, it's kind of that could be similar to that.
I just wonder what the audience thought at the end of this because it's happening on stage.
Yeah.
A murder attempt and a fight and the guy admitting he did wrong and capturing somebody all on stage. Yeah. Another day in Gotham.
Yeah, that's true.
Another posh event ruined by the Batman family.
I think they just come to expect it at this point. They're just coming looking for something messy.
And the fact that it took place on stage did make me think of the Batman 66 episode with the Joker, with the opera, Pagliacci.
I know the studio has high ceilings, because of course it does, it's Gotham, but why does she swing in to stop the bomb?
There's a lot of mystery swinging, because if you look at the splash page, the very first page, she's swinging from the clouds.
I know.
That's like true. Spider-Man, the Spider-Man cartoon from the 60s. Yes. Nothing to swing. Hang on to.
Actually, to defend, I could see a rehearsal space having high ceilings. Now, I understand, are she really going to swing in? I'm a little bit more lenient with
you
that.
See the lighting.
The high ceilings I get, but why is she swinging in? Grab the bomb and run.
Well, she needed to do the intimidating. They do a good job of showing the ceiling often and the light fixtures. Yeah. So there's something to attach the bat line to. But page four, there's like the intimidating shadow. We need to do that. And then she swings in.
And I know it's hokey, but the last page when she's going up against Philippe and he's rongeteeing her and stuff like that. And I don't know if Max listens to this, but it reminds me of Whirling Dervish, the Plastic Man villain.
And she sweeps the leg. It's got pretty good action.
Yeah, I like that too. I thought that was pretty good.
They should have given that more space. They should have given half a page or something like that.
Agreed.
And she chops on him neck so hard it turns his hair green.
I saw that, yeah.
Yeah, mine's miscolored too. There, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't have anything else on this one, Sean.
Oh, I thought we were going to go 20 more minutes on it. But if you want to do bat branding, we will do bat branding. This is where we talk about all of the ads and letter pages and things like that. And we're going to start off with a real anomaly. It is a Hostess ad that almost kind of sort of makes sense.
Because it doesn't have one of those hokey villains.
So it's Green Arrow, an arrow in time. He's there with like a cable car and he sees the cable car lines are fraying and coming apart. So of course he whips 1400 arrows to secure the cable car. And then he arrows in some fruit pies. You know how I feel about fruit pies. But it kind of makes sense because it's probably going to be a while until they get rescued. The kids are probably upset. I would send some Twinkies and all of that kind of stuff. But Hostess fruit pie, that's fine. And then they say, thanks for the rescue, Green Arrow. Thanks for the Hostess fruit pies. He says, glad my efforts were on target.
I'm a big Green Arrow fan. I like him a lot. The only thing I thought was sort of odd about this was they never have like a clear picture of his face. Everything's sort of from the back. Or the side, which is sort of odd because you'd almost, I assume this is Kurt Swan, right?
Yeah, I think he did most of them, if not all.
Yeah. I just thought that was sort of odd, especially someone like Green Arrow who you don't see that often.
Yeah
that's an interesting point. I didn't notice that.
Yeah.
Now we'll talk about the absolute very best thing in this entire issue. It is a full page ad for the digest, the two digests I was talking about earlier. And it's 10 plus 4 plus 132 plus 95. The numbers that add up to the year's Best Buy in comics. And there are 10 top 10 stories of 1979, 4 best covers of the year, 132 pages, 95 cents in DC's exciting new blue ribbon digest size. And then down in a little circular dot, it says, and if that isn't enough, don't dare miss the classic adventures of the Flash and his friends. So I was talking about the Flash digest earlier. I got my Flash Digest at Uffelman's newsstand in Spring Grove. Mm. And after that, I had a dentist appointment. So I walked up the street to the dentist and I was there super early. So I sat in a chair with my feet crossed at the ankles and I was reading my digest and I was super way into it. And so it was a while I was reading it. When they called me to get up, I hadn't realized that my leg had fallen asleep. So I went to stand up and I fell down.
And broke a tooth.
But no.
That's how that story should end.
But it was worth it because I love every single story in this issue. Fantastic cover. On the back cover, around the border, it's Flash doing speed tricks.
Oh, very cool. Yeah.
Like it is. I love this issue. It's the first time I realized that Kid Flash's original outfit was just the Flash's outfit.
Right.
Which I never realized that, which is horrible. I don't know how they got away with that. It's one of my favorite all three Flash stories, Doomward Flight of the Flashes. I love it. I can't say enough things about this issue. I wish we were talking about these two books instead of this issue. Whoops. I mean, maybe Paul edit that out.
The next one is, and the centerfold, 3/4 of the centerfold is taken up by Fun Factory and Grit ads. But what I really like is a half page ad. This is the beginning, and it's for the Untold Legend of the Batman. And I loved this when it came out. And I remember when I first saw it, I was like, whoa, Byrne and Aparo. And I just thought it was great. I learned later why John Byrne only did one issue. And that was because apparently he had a hole in his schedule over at Marvel and he could do 3 issues. And DC scheduled him. But Len Wein was so late getting him the scripts that he only got time to do 1 issue. And so Jim Aparo did the rest, which is fine. But I really thought that was great. You know, one of the things I looked up was where this has been reprinted. And it's only been reprinted in the Tales of the Batman Len Wein, which is way out of print, and Legends of the Batman Jim Aparo Volume 3. That one I do have. I just think this would make a great deluxe edition. You could even combine it with some other origin type stories, either Batman or other characters. I think it still holds up. Now, I haven't read it for a little while, but I have read it multiple times over the years. So one of my favorites. So I just wanted to point that out.
Well, and a couple of things. First of all, if you haven't read The Untold Legend of the Batman, absolutely read it, because it's a fantastic story. It's so neat the way it's done, because there is a mystery involved. Mm-hmm. And then that mystery has Batman going through all of his past cases. It's such a great framing device. Also, those 3 issues were given away as serial prizes, probably with the Batman 89 serial, I think.
Well, I know there was a little one attached to a cassette, and I had 1 issue like that.
I was also going to say there is an audio adaption of the entire series, and that definitely you can get on YouTube.
JLGL did the covers for it.
Yeah,
my close personal friend. You saw that, Sean. You were there, Sean.
The next ad we're going to talk about is a little, we have it listed as 1/3 page. It might even be smaller than that.
Yeah.
But it's, the superstars of comics are superstars of TV too. Don't miss any of the DC heroes in animated action. And it's Super Friends, and they're coming out of a little TV set. And it's Batman, and he's coming out of a little TV set. And now Plastic Man, and he's coming out of a little TV set. And it's all reused stuff. Plastic Man is from the first time he was in Adventure Comics, right? I think.
I don't know where it's from, but yeah.
Chris Franklin, where's that middle Batman from? Because I don't know that one.
Looked like Dick Giordano, but it's hard to tell when it's that little.
And Siskoid, if you were looking for your kung fu in this issue, look no further than the top of this page.
Yeah. Yeah, but I did watch those 3 cartoons.
So I
wasn't yet reading English comics, English language comics, but I was watching English language TV.
Excellent. Is that the Batman one that was using Adam West for the voice?
It's the one that the Batmite was always in.
Yes.
And he was like pink colored instead of the blue. Yeah.
On the opposite page of that is a really neat ad I really like. Special super savings offer, where every S is a dollar sign instead of an S. They should have made every S a Superman sign instead of a dollar sign, in my opinion. But if you buy any of these magazines at Newspan, you'll pay $4 for 10 issues. But if you subscribe, you'll pay $4 and you'll get 12 issues. So saving money. And you got Superman holding up all his titles, Superman in Action and DC Comics Presents, in really cool little stands. I wish I had one of those stands that he's holding, because they look really cool. Looks like Kurt Schaffenberger.
That's what I would have said. Yeah.
Yeah.
And really a neat subscription ad. I love the specialized subscription ads where there is certain characters or whatever. I was reading a Silver Age Atom, and even he had one back in the day.
I wanted to talk about that. So I recognize this style of subscription. They're all one pages. They all have that corner box that you're supposed to cut out. Last month we talked about the Detective
Comics. There was a Detective Comics one. Yep.
I would really like to see all of them that were done in this style. There's the one where Superman is talking to Carol Fiend. There's the Super Friends one. And I wonder, did they have them? Because I never read Warlord or any of the Sword and Sorcery or the mystery titles, the Ghost.
I'm pretty sure they had the mystery title ones, but I don't know.
Probably, yeah. And it's funny because I know you can go online and get the Daily Planets and the Hembex and all of that. I wonder if anyone has like collected all of these subscription ads, because I'd like to see them, because they were like specifically designed with new art and that kind of stuff.
Isamu, you on that?
I did not want... No, I
let that kid live. Got him looking up Matches Malone last month.
He should not be doing all of our work. So do not do that.
Isamu, go outside.
Okay, we're going to close it out with the Batcave. And as always, we are inviting Gary Thompson, Roger Schoolcraft, and unsigned, if you're listening.
Forgot to sign it, but he left his address.
Yeah, unsigned from 330 Friar Tuck Drive, Schreyerville, Indiana. I don't really have a ton of stuff to pull from the letters because almost all of the letters are all agreeing with what we were saying about all of these stories. I do want to pull out Gary Thompson said, let's face it, although the Dynamite duo are certainly talented, they're simply not cut out for epic confrontations with a Ra's al Ghul or Joker. It's not a matter of men being better than women or children. It's simply a matter of there being one and only Batman. Besides, who says the whole mag has to be identical to its lead feature anyway? I always liked variety myself. Good job, Gary. I agree. And then Roger Schoolcraft says, in terms of the Roy Raymond TV detective story, it will hopefully not return often.
I love it.
Though while I didn't particularly dislike it, I did dislike the fact that it bumped out the Human Target this go round. Agreed. Although I think in the letters pages, they actually say, it's not that we're not publishing Human Target. We just don't have it. He hasn't finished the story yet. So that's why it's not.
He's still calling out Len Wein and Dick Giordano. Yeah, as soon as Len and Dick get their act together in another episode, we'll rush it into print. The only thing I had on the last one, the unsigned, was complaining about the page count, which I thought that was funny. He's, you know, I counted the pages of new material in Detective Comics number 487, 53 to last issue's 54. I'm not the type to nitpick, but I would seriously prefer to pay $115 or $125 for the 64-page no-ads package.
I think you are someone who is, you know.
I'm not one to nitpick. However, you are this one. This is my nitpick.
Yes.
And then he also said, Roy Raymond was closer to an idea of a special story, although the plot line was, again, pedestrian. There's that word again. And the Dapont art matched it as well. Ouch. And then predicts the thing about the Odd Man. He says, it will doubtless win a place in the Comic Book Hall of Fame close to the Geek, the Dingbats of Danger Street, and Simon and Grandinetti's Gone and Happily Almost Forgotten the Outsiders. I love that.
No wonder he was unsigned.
Sean, you didn't mention the little ad at the bottom.
Oh, I didn't. It's for the Adventure Comics that I was just reading. Starman and Plastic Man, Every Month an Adventure. I can wholeheartedly recommend those issues.
All right, ready to move on?
Yes.
Now we're ready to move on to the epic of the issue. It is a Tales of Gotham City, a three-pager by Bob Rozakis, George Tuska, and Bob Smith. And it is entitled Encounter, or as I like to call it, Paul Levitz telling Bob Rozakis that George Tuska is showing up here in an hour and I need three pages to give him. A woman heads to work in the very early morning during a snowstorm and has trouble getting her car out of a snowdrift. Meanwhile, a radio host interviews a police lieutenant who outlines dangerous situations that the vulnerable should avoid, like being a single woman stuck in your car in a snowdrift when no one is around to help, for example. Someone approaches the car and the woman panics. She tries to escape, but the person is a police officer who is out there helping her and others. He pushes her car out of the snowdrift and she goes to work. The end.
Yep. This is not the Gotham City we know today.
No.
Because I like the idea of these short stories, but I think they'd be more interesting in the modern era where Gotham is a cesspool. And wasn't there like a recent TikTok, or I'm not on that, but it's people doing videos as if they live in the actual Gotham City and they're talking about their actual funny problems.
Oh, really?
I've seen some of those videos. They're actually pretty well made. And it's a trend, of course. If it's TikTok, I guess, you know, everybody starts doing it. But it's people in their cars and they're just doing the usual TikToking, vlogging, but they live in Gotham.
Something blows up.
Blows up. They're in a traffic jam and there's Joker gas outside the window and stuff like that. I think there's potential for these kinds of stories, but they need to be much darker than what this is. This is the opposite of a Gotham City story.
I just thought it was dull. Is it supposed to be a message? The police are friendly. Don't go out too late. I don't know. Brett?
I'd rather see one about the realtor in Gotham. 3-bedroom condo, cathedral ceilings, $500 a month. Yeah, sure.
I think that was one of the TikTok videos. There's people talking about how their rent is so low.
Oh, that's too funny.
Like these huge studio apartments for almost nothing.
I don't know. I wrote down, I'd rather read three hostess ads, but... Sean, you didn't say anything yet.
Paul, I'm sorry. You might have to edit this. So while you guys were talking, I was looking at the Digest ad and just focusing in on that. So sorry. No, that
is that is all nostalgia talking. I'm the one person on the network who doesn't like the Digest format. I think it's unreadable.
Thank you, Siskoid, for appearing on our show. Now, Brett, tell us all about...
Click. Boo.
No, so this story's fine. I have no problem with a three-page story in theory. There's nothing horrible or wrong with it, but what's the point? I don't know.
The best thing about it, in my opinion, is it gives us a chance to talk about Bob Smith. sources from, again, Mike's Amazing World and Wikipedia, and there's a great article at a website called nerdteam30.com. So Robert Allen with an E, Smith, better known as Bob Smith, was born in 1951 in Aberdeen, Washington, and grew up in Washington State. Now, there's apparently a mid-century modern fine artist named Robert Allen with an A, Smith, and these are not the same people. So we're talking about Bob Smith, comic artist. Bob graduated in 1974 from Western Washington State College, where he took courses in drawing and painting. And according to Bob, I'd gotten interested in comics only a couple years earlier. I'd never been that interested before that. I was interested in cartooning and such, but comic books? No. Somehow, though, I managed to get fascinated by it. I was hanging around this bookstore and buying old comics and stuff, and I'd started to do some artwork. I showed it to the owner of the bookstore, and he said, "You should really show that to John Workman." So I gave John a call and got together with him, and we started collaborating after that. They became friends, and in 1975, he moved to New York with Workman to give it a go in the comics business. They got work almost immediately. It actually took about a week and a couple of trips up to D.C. We managed to get in to see Carmine Infantino, and he seemed to like our work. And John got a job in production right away. Of course, if you don't know, John Workman, famous letterer. I was given Plastic Man. We did some stuff for Marvel, too. Some work for Crazy Magazine. Money was starting to run out pretty fast. We were staying in a motel on Staten Island. I'd heard horror stories about people who tried for years to get work and just couldn't find anything. How we managed to get something within just a few days, it would be impossible today. I thought that was interesting. Smith entered mainstream comics with a story named The Bogus Men Will Get You If You Don't Watch Out, which is in Plastic Man number 12, providing inks over network favorite Ramona Fraiden. Another quote from Bob, they were talking about everything folding up. We were told by people that you could probably get a job, but the whole business will likely go under in the next 6 months. But Bob was lucky enough to weather through the DC implosion due to being under contract at that time. He worked for DC almost exclusively until 1998, inking numerous titles, including, of course, Plastic Man and the Super Friends, but also entries in Who's Who, Black Canary, Detective Comics, like here, Freedom Fighters, Flash, Green Lantern, Huntress, Secrets of Haunted House, Star Trek, everything. He had a few penciling credits early on, but settled in as an inker pretty quickly. Why? In his own words, he says, "I was doing some penciling for Crazy Magazine for about the first year, but they liked the look of my inking, so I started inking. And unlike some guys who started out inking like Jerry Ordway, I just sort of shifted over from penciling and just kept inking. I was faster at it. Every time I tried penciling, I was just so slow at it that I just found I couldn't make any money at it. I wasn't doing enough of it to pick up any speed. I can do a couple of pages a day, although on things like Plastic Man and Super Friends, I could do 3 pages a day. On superhero stuff, I'm a lot slower." On particular pencilers, Bob had this to say. "Gene Colan seemed to like my inks. He had such a strong style that you always knew immediately who it was, no matter who inks it. Garcia Lopez seemed to like what I did, too. Russ Andrew and Carmine Infantino were tougher for Bob to ink," he said. "Those guys left 2 or 3 different lines to choose from, and you had to kind of pick the right one. I always felt that I picked the wrong line to ink. I never really liked what I had done over Carmine for that reason," which I thought was neat. Bob mentioned in the article that he really enjoyed inking Gene Colan, but his favorites also included Ramona Fraiden and Dick Giordano. He wishes he could have done more over Garcia Lopez. He felt like he didn't do injustice on Atari Force. He also mentions that he was more in the Batman side of the house at DC and never got the chance to ink Kurt Swan or Gil Kane, to his regret. In 1998, Smith was looking for work, and a friend suggested he contact Victor Gorelick at Archie Comics. So I called him, and he sent me some photocopies of things to do. I sent some samples over, and he seemed to like them and said, "I'm not sure I could give you much work." The next thing I know, I had more work than I could handle. So that worked out pretty well. I'll say, according to Mike's Amazing World, that started a 25-year relationship with Archie Comics, almost 4,800 pages inked over 760 stories. That is almost 2/3 of his career output. In addition, Smith was the penciler for the Archie Comics strip, the newspaper strip, that was written by our past Bat guest, Craig Boldman. 3 final stories of notes regarding Bob Smith. Number one, he worked on many special projects for Joe Orlando, like licensing art for Atari, but he really liked working on the Superhero Stamp album that came out in like 2000 or so. He had fun, he said, inking various artists, but they never gave him comp copies, and he has never seen any of the stamps. I was like, oh, poor guy. Number two, he also had a page in the September 11th tribute book that DC put out. In his own words, "I hadn't received any work from DC in about a year or so, but I heard that this was happening. So I called Paul Levitz, and I asked if I could do a page for it. I wanted to be involved in it. I think he just sat down and wrote one for Joe Staten and me. I believe that's how it happened. It made me feel good, whatever the circumstances might have been, which is nice. And Brett, you will love this last one. Bob has a definite fondness for inking and participating in Batmite's New York adventure. He thought that was really fun. As far as I can tell, Bob Smith is still with us. In the interview, he said he really didn't think he would ever retire. But his last credit, Mike's Amazing World, is from May of 2023. That says he certainly had nothing to be ashamed about. Over 1,260 story credits totaling 13,500 pages over a 50-year career. So very impressive. So I hope you enjoyed hearing a little bit about his life.
Yeah. It was also the name of my ninth grade English teacher. He liked to make us do book reports on James Bond and Chuck Norris films.
Oh,
when you got angry, he broke a long ruler across your desk.
Ooh.
Wow.
Were your hands underneath it at the time?
No.
Okay. Glad to hear that.
Well, I always enjoy it when we climb up on Uncle Paul's knee and hear about somebody new ever. And I'm telling you, I always say this, but it's my favorite part of the show. I always
enjoy it. Very kind. It's
a great job.
Thank you.
When he talks, I always look up the, like in this case, Bob Smith. Like I'm looking up his artwork. Mm-hmm. So I always do that, which it's harder when it's a writer. But okay, our fourth story is The Deadly Answers, starring Robin. It is 8 pages, written by Jack C. Harris, penciled by Alex Sauviak, inked by John Cownan, and it was later reprinted in Robin, the Bronze Age Omnibus hardcover from 2020. Robin in The Deadly Answers. Our story begins the way all great works of literature should start, with our main character stripping down to his Speedos. In this case, it's because Robin is returning from his nightly patrol and needs to change to Dick Grayson in a hurry because his new friend Jennifer is on her way to see him. He makes it just in time, but Jennifer has horrible news. Someone has been caught with the answer sheet to her physiology midterm for her nursing class, and now everyone has to retake the test. Bad news for Jennifer means good news for us readers, because that means we'll get to see Robin investigate the case. He begins his legwork by dropping in on the class itself, run by Professor Madman Milton, who announces that to be absolutely fair to everyone, the second test must be twice as difficult. Better hit those books extra hard, Jenny. Robin figures out that the only students who would need to cheat are those who are failing the class. And to get that info, Robin sets off a chemical charge so that the security guard named Billy Baldwin leaves his post guarding the filing cabinet that holds the student records. He finds out that 3 of the students are failing, and then swings over to the student switchboard where he intercepts a call to John Douglas, who the mastermind is contacting to set up a day and time to get the new answer key. At midnight, the fake John Douglas, Robin, Natch, is about to unmask the criminal when the 2 other failing students interrupt his bust by pulling a gun on the bad guy. Robin stops the 2 new students from firing, but in the melee, the masked man got away. Robin talks to Billy Baldwin, who tells him that no unauthorized personnel has passed this way, which makes Robin realize that the person who was selling the answer sheet was none other than Professor Madman. Oh, I forgot to mention it in my synopsis, but all the way through the story, Robin has been followed by the Man in Black, not that one, who I'm sure will turn up in a future story, so we'll talk about him then. What did you guys think of the story? Let's start with Siskoid.
Well, university affairs are my world, or used to be my world. I worked for a student union for 12 years, and I worked at that university in other capacities before then, largely fighting this kind of corruption. So people who don't work at a university would never imagine if you went to university, you might suspect, but I can confirm there's a lot of corruption within the faculty. A lot of teachers, professors don't care about students. They're just there for the research and for grants and such. A lot of them have these ideas that, you know, like this, the makeup test is twice as hard as the original test, which would screw all the students who weren't cheating. This is not allowed. This is the kind of stuff that is not allowed usually in college procedures. Students have rights, which are codified. And this would go against student rights, which does not stop professors from doing it because they trade on the fact that the students don't know any better. And then they say, I'm the professor here. I will do what I want. So this felt true to life until the professor was in a supervillain cowl.
Brett, what did you think about it?
It was silly, but I enjoyed it. You know, I like the hip lingo, the why the big crumble, he asked her. That was a great line when Jennifer shows up all sobbing about the test. I guess people can just smoke anywhere at on campus.
There's a lot of smoking.
He's in the cabin. Yeah. I mean, this guy's trying to be inconspicuous following Dick Grayson around, and he's just like blowing smoke like he's Marlene Dietrich. I don't know what he's doing. I think he should go with the switchboard girl, though, than Jennifer. She seems like more fun and can keep it together better.
She's like, I've always wanted to meet you. I bet you did. Watch out, Jennifer.
Yeah, let me handle this first, and then I'll be back. Apparently, all I do is swing around campus on what? I don't know, but it was fun. It was silly. But
and they don't give a name to the, I mean, they call him Madman, but he doesn't have like a supervillain name, except at one point, Robin calls him the answer man. Yeah, the answer student man, with the gun says the masked answer man. So I wonder if this is supposed to be like a Bob Rozakis joke.
Yeah, I absolutely think so. What did you think of the story, Paul?
It's okay. A couple of things I laughed at. You have Robin coming home super late from his patrol, but then he complains that there's nothing happening on campus. So why was he later patrol?
I kind of think he was out late hoping to get something.
I'd like Mrs. Higgins, the landlady, coming by and saying, keep that door open, mister. You know, I like that. And he's got a poster of Batman in his room, which I think is funny. There's another Jack C. Harris thing where he just figures it out based on the comment of the security guard. So I don't know. I'm more interested in who is the man in black.
Jack C. Harris, the C stands for comment.
I like when he's wearing the disguise and the trench coat. You can see his booties.
That is funny. Page 7. Yeah, that's funny.
Oh, yeah, I didn't even notice that. I like the story. I like the art. It's only 8 pages, but it moves quickly for being 8 pages. It's not a Fair Play mystery at all. But I liked it. It's nice to have, you know, a campus crime and that kind of thing. I don't think we're going to go beat by beat because I think we already did. Because I think my synopsis was fantastic at that.
Again, for me, the first couple pages were the best. Mrs. What's-her-name and him throwing his costume under his bed and the speed is walking up the drain pipe. I just think that's funny.
The drain pipe does remind me of the opening of the Ra's al Ghul story. I feel like that's how he gets into the room.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Anytime he does that, that always reminds me of that. All right, now we are going to move on to our fifth story. The fifth story is called Lightning Strikes Out, starring Black Lightning. 10 pages, written by Martin Pascoe, penciled by Pat Broderick, inked by Frank McLaughlin, and it was reprinted in Black Lightning Volume 2 trade paperback from 2018. Black Lightning in Lightning Strikes Out. Our story starts off like a Human Target story, right in the middle of the action with Black Lightning chained to a wall with flames all around him. We then flashback, number one, to Jeff Pierce, Black Lightning, playing basketball with one of his students, Lincoln Trask. We find out it's not just a friendly game, but rather part of a court-appointed program to keep Lincoln out of trouble. But in the shower room after the practice, Lincoln is kidnapped. Jeff changes into Black Lightning and goes to Mama Mambu's apothecary because he saw a Haitian voodoo fetish hanging from the rearview mirror of the van. Not Dick Grayson's van that kidnapped Lincoln. Black Lightning starts to disarm the bad guys in a fantastic way by electromagnetizing the van. But the bad guys sneak up behind him and conk him out. Flashback number two shows us that this all started when Lincoln's sister, Wandine, came to see Jeff because Lincoln was going to Mama Mambu's to do something terrible because their mother wouldn't listen to her doctor and instead took the quote-unquote medicine that Mama promised would cure her. Jeff slash Black Lightning went to Mama's to stop Lincoln, which he did, but not before Lincoln destroyed lots of Mama's fake medicine, and is why Jeff is appointed to make sure that Lincoln doesn't get into any other trouble. We then return to the present, where we see BL tied to the wall, and we meet Jacques, who wants to get revenge against Lincoln for all of the destruction to the shop that he calls. And get revenge he does, because his cronies are giving Lincoln the once over, then the twice over, and then the third over. Then, in a typical villain maneuver, Jacques leaves BL to die. But that's so that we are able to see the conversation that he has with Mama Mambu. You see, two flashbacks aren't enough for this story. Oh no. We get flashback number three, which tells us that Mama had a dream vision about a man who would save them from their enemies. A man who is a human host of a powerful voodoo god or spirit who they now believe is Black Lightning after seeing him stop Lincoln from destroying their store by using his lightning. The trap that they set for Black Lightning was only so that they could find out what magic words he used to bring forth the lightning. Well, as we know, that's not how Black Lightning works. So when they don't get what they want, the bad guys beat a hasty retreat from the fire. Black Lightning, though, suffers because he has inadvertently knocked himself out, short-circuited himself, by using his lightning powers as the fire alarm sprinkler system has gone off. To be continued.
Bum, bum, bum.
What did you think of the story, Brett?
I like Pat Broderick. I like his art. It's nice to see him do a real hero instead of Firestorm or something.
Okay, first I kick off Siskoid for the Digest comment. Then I kick off Brett, who will not be a fourth-time guest.
I always say he's always very excessive with his speed lines. It looks like the basketball is being bounced at light speed. You know, he always steps up with his speed lines. I like his art. I have to note the Dr. J reference.
Yes.
Anytime Julius Erving is mentioned, I have to take notice. Screw you, Larry Bird. Doctor was the best. I was trying to remember, wasn't there a time when the first time I ever saw Black Lightning was the Justice League issue where they tried to recruit him? Didn't his hair used to be part of the mask?
Like, at one point.
Wear a wig?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
So he stopped doing that at this point.
Yes.
So it's
yes.
not part of his. Yeah. Okay. And the flames were a little inconsistent. It looked like the whole room was on fire. And then the last page, it looked like the little fire pit in the corner. But that was kind of a little off with the art. I don't understand why he's dead or why supposedly dead. He does the thing and then he sets off the sprinklers, right?
So the fire was already going and then he used his electrical power and then the sprinkler system went off and the water hit him as electricity was flowing through his body.
Oh, wow, it's still flowing through him. Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. Comic book science. I don't know.
All right.
Because I predict that's a big lie at the end there. Next. They're going, he's dead. And the career of the new Black Lightning begins. So they're making it like we just introduced Black Lightning to kill him off and make this new kid, Lincoln, the new Black Lightning. That's what they're doing in the in there. And that's not what happens.
That's not what happens.
Yeah. Right. What did you think of it, Paul?
I thought it was okay. I like Black Lightning. I have those two trade paperbacks. I had a number of his issues back in the day. I'm never totally comfortable with the language.
The jive talk.
Black Lightning's an educator. He's an Olympic athlete.
But this is a secret identity thing.
And that's a secret identity thing, but I still
because he only speaks like that when he's in costume.
Right. So, I mean, I get it. But I like him. I think he's got interesting powers, at least until now. Spoiler. He's a cool guy. I liked him. I know you don't like the Outsiders. I liked him in that. I think they've done a lot of good things with him over the years, except when he was the Secretary of Education under Lex Luthor. Other than that, I think he's a cool character. So I'm glad to see him.
Let's be clear, Paul. It's not that I don't like the Outsiders. I disdain the Outsiders. But I mean the Outsiders who were created for the Outsider series. So Black Lightning and Metamorpho are just
they're great.
Innocent victims of Mike Barr's writing.
Pawns,
Fair enough.
Shout out to Tim Price.
Tim's been on the show. We liked him.
I like this story. I think it is herky-jerky with the flashbacks. Like,
yeah.
There are three flashbacks in this story to set it up. Unlike Brett, I love Firestorm, the nuclear man, and Pat Broderick was the artist most, especially for Fury, a Firestorm. He literally drew high school kids all the time. So I don't know why Lincoln Trask looks like he's a 34-year-old man. He looks like he's older than Jeff.
He does.
So that, I didn't like that.
Yeah, he did. That's a great name, by the way. Lincoln Trask. Like a corrupt senator or something.
I have a note here, Brett, that there's no afro attached, but I like how he's got his costume in the file cabinet and then he drapes the mask over the file cabinet drawers. He's getting dressed. I don't know. I thought that was really a nice touch, realistic.
I wasn't expecting to hear about Suicide Slum's voodoo scene. They also pulled that card in the Luke Cage TV series. So
I don't quite get that, but it is what it is.
I do kind of like that the villain, I'm not going to say that the villains were misguided, that the villains didn't understand his power source and thought he was, so I'm not going to know what
Aloha.
The Johnny Quick 3XY or Shazam. They felt like he said something. So I thought that part was interesting.
I agree.
Even kind of how Jefferson is set up as Lincoln's, not guardian, but to make sure he doesn't get in trouble. Yeah. But here, like, trouble is coming to get him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I thought that was cool.
Yeah.
I mean, the plot's good. Marty Pasco is a good writer. We like him both for comics and animation, right? Definitely makes me want to read the next one.
Isn't this the third story in a row where I'm not counting the cop pushing woman's car story, but the Batgirl and the Robin and this one all have villains with the same generic black hoods?
Oh, that's weird.
Oh, yeah.
The kidnappers have it in Black Lightning. Teacher had it in Robin. Yeah. And the dancer had it in the beginning when he's sniping at the house.
All written and drawn by different people too.
There was a sale.
Ski masks are easily available, well, everywhere, but I guess Gotham City has a particular market.
One thing I did want to point out, though, on page 5, when Wandine comes to Jefferson and she's talking about how their mother is sick, she holds up the bottle And the label says, Mama Mamboo's placebo brand. Real good root extract.
Yeah, I guess you can't sue her if it doesn't work. Right there on the bottle.
That is not respecting your clientele. That's just giving them morons.
Page 9 is pretty good. I like the top left where Black Lightning breaks the chains off. He looks good there. He's straining. He says those straps were only strong enough to hold a 98-pound Winkling. Against an Olympic gold medal winner like me, they don't stand a chance. I guess if I was an Olympic gold medal winner, I'd remind myself of it all the time.
I would be reminding everyone of it every day.
Well, I'm not convinced of the accent that they give these Haitians, the French accent.
Oh, there's the Zoot alors.
Zoot alors.
Sounds very French from France. When they use French words, again, the grammar is good and the spelling is right, which is, again, very rare in comics. Very rare.
Well, maybe Paul Levitt spoke French. We don't know.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. Somebody.
Good first effort for Black Lightning. If you guys are ready to move on, we are going to take a trip to Gabriel's Horn, which is, of course, the hip happening hangout for the Teen Titans in the 70s and for at least a few months into 1980. We're going to talk about the most 70s moment in the issue from any of the stories. So let's start with that first story. What do you guys have? Brett, you got anything?
I don't know if this, I guess they still use those, but I thought using the meat hook as a weapon, that kind of the creator meat hook, I thought was pretty cool. Him having to write with a marker on the back computer screen.
That's what I had. The big back computer was really the best one I had in this. How about you, Siskoy? Did you have anything in this story?
Well, I alluded to it earlier that the word Oriental
is
today the wrong word to use in this instance. But the whole idea, 79 is late for this, but the kung fu craze of the 70s is carrying over into these kinds of concepts and the sensei. And that's kind of part of it. That makes it kind of 70s.
Yep. Sean, did you have anything here? Or
just the plastic see-through with a marker. Yeah.
Move on to Batgirl. I had nothing in Batgirl. Did any of you guys have anything in Batgirl?
I didn't.
Maybe the beltless suits that Philippe wears, stuff like that.
Okay.
Like none of those guys wear belts. They don't seem to even have any loops or anything like that.
Okay. I thought that was dance attire. But
Are you
in the beginning, like the first couple pages like that? I didn't look at that as dance attire.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Page 2. Yeah, I see it. Maybe.
But it's a story that could happen anytime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Moving on to Tails. I actually had two. One.
In Tails?
Yeah. The gear shift on the steering wheel.
Oh,
nice. Oh, yeah. Very good.
Yeah. And then the other one was kind of more of a jokey, having to go to work instead of working remotely on a day like that. So, you know, maybe she's a doctor or nurse or something.
But I'm looking for that gear shift.
Top of page 2, top left corner. She's shifting gears.
They don't have those anymore on the wheel?
I haven't seen a car with that for a long time.
But... Okay.
And even the door locks,
the door locks, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There's like a push button.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Same kind of thing. And then Robin.
Brett already stole mine.
The smoking?
Yeah.
Smoking in a cafeteria, smoking in public places, not outside. Yeah.
Well, the obvious one was the switchboard for the men's dormitory.
And even dorms today are very often co-ed. So there wouldn't be like the matron standing over Jennifer's shoulder.
Keep the door
open.
Yeah. And I forgot to look it up, but Dick mentions new privacy rules. We think about the privacy rules all the time. It was a new enough thing that they remarked upon it, which I thought was, but I forgot to look up what might have actually passed right before this, but they talked about that. Black Lightning. Brad, I know you're going to talk about their shorts.
The basketball shorts are a little short, yeah. And Dr. J, of course, the Dr. J reference. I mentioned that again.
Yes.
Right. And of course, the jive, which is Black Lightning, was a
language in general.
Right. He talked like in a blaxploitation movie, but that was part of a shtick. So even at this point, but other people are using jive as well. The bad guys are talking in jive as well.
When using the blackjack, he's using one of those blackjacks to knock him over the head. Old school.
Oh, good one.
I wanted to talk about the shorty shorts, but no.
go ahead. Dr. J. I don't know why he said me. I just because I was talking about basketball. like a Sean thing.
On page 10, they talk about being Kentucky Fried Turkeys, which Kentucky Fried Chicken was a huge big deal. I think the biggest one, or the most telling, is on page 9.
Yes.
When he says, I hope I don't have to do that again. My head's pounding like a teletype on election day.
That is good. And the wicker-backed wheelchair.
Oh, yeah.
That's supposed to be from the old country. She's an Asian voodoo bungan or something. Yeah. So that's even older than 70s.
Well, that wraps it up for this issue. We want to thank our special guests, Brett Young and Siskoid, for stopping by the reunion this month. Can you guys tell our listeners where they can find you? Siskoid, we'll start with you.
I still write daily content about comics, games, movies, and TV at Siskoid's blog of Geekery. That's as Googleable as ever. And on this very network, I publish an episode of one of my various shows every Tuesday. These days, usually, we'll have more or not. FW Team Up or Siskoid Cinema.
And Brett, how about you?
Well, I'm a graphic designer by trade. My company is Imagine 8 Design, imagine8design.com, Blue Sky, Imagine 8 Design. Instagram is Imagine 8 Design. So I have a TeePublic account under Cool Jeep. I'm on these shows here and there, so I'm around there too.
All right. Now we are going to play a podcast promo, and when we return, we will read and respond to your listener feedback.
Siskoid watches a lot of movies, like a lot. So now he has his own movie podcast, or several. Siskoid Cinema is your one-stop umbrella for a variety of shows like Fade In, exploring the first films of famous actors and directors.
This is a joke, right?
On Borrowed Time, discussing all your favorite time travel movies.
Whoa, this is heavy.
Why are things so heavy in the future? Is there a problem with the Earth's gravitational pull?
And No Escape from Kurt Russell. A dissection of the man, the mystique, and the movies.
There goes a perfectly good bumper sticker.
And more. Siskoid Cinema, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Welcome back. Now we will read and respond to your listener feedback for episode 489, Crisis on Multiple Computers, Bogus Butlers, and an Out-of-Character Robin. First up, who else but our favorite Bat-Nephew, Isamu Hideki Yukinori. Fun talk, Uncle Paul, Uncle Sean, and Uncle Chris. I have another question from the first Batman story. I presume Sweet Moon was the killer in the first scene and used a dove to make it appear the vampire was flying away. But can a mere dove knock the bat rope out of Batman's grip? Or was that actually Ivorn trying to get Batman's attention so he would notice the murder? I suppose that is two questions.
Yeah, that is a good question. I mean, I don't know. I had assumed it was a real vampire, Ivorn, but again, it gets back to the why. I don't know. What do you think?
I don't think a dove would be strong enough to knock right, it
the
out.
The bat rope?
Yeah, exactly. Isamu goes on to say, oh, and Uncle Sean, I just, quote unquote, happen to have a list of all of the Matches Malone appearances from pre-crisis to Zero Hour, which I compiled in part as research for my Super Friends Index project, and part curiosity because I wanted to know the deal behind Batman's often used underworld alter ego. So then, Isamu goes on to list 20 or so appearances of Matches Malone, starting with Batman 242, where the real Matches died and Batman assumes his identity. I want everyone to be sure to check out his post on the website.
Absolutely.
And Isamu, I think that you already know how much we appreciate your work, but I just want you to be sure that we really appreciate your work.
Absolutely. You're great, Isamu. We love having you part of the family.
He then goes on with, Astrolad may not have had a who's who entry, but he did get a half page Zooms Who, not Who Zooms, by the way, entry in Zooms Who Volume 1. And he, of course, posted an image of Astrolad from Zooms Who. Very cool. Yeah, that book is great. And there's going to be a Volume 2. And I can't wait. Oh, I'm so happy about that. And then he goes on, wow. Batgirl's memories of Batman and Robin's identities, two names, took up a whole cassette? I wonder how many cassettes they went through to restore the rest of the 25 years of her life. Regarding the Adam story, I can confirm Uncle Chris's Adventure Comics theory is correct. Page 112 of the comic book implosion book by Two Morrows states that the story was originally supposed to appear in Adventure Comics 467 when it was originally planned as a dollar comic. The book also shows an unused cover by Jim Aparo with a little vignette of the Adam story at the upper left, and he posted that cover image. Unfortunately, the sales of the dollar comic version of Adventure were not good, so they switched back to the 40-cent format to keep it in publication. The stories planned for this issue were eventually printed in other DC comics like this detective issue. Incidentally, the Aquaman story was printed in World's Finest 262, one of Uncle Sean's picks from the Bat timeline. All right.
I read that book too, Simon. I forgot all about that. Great catch. Chris also made the same comment, so good job all alone. But not done yet. Isamu brought some more knowledge about the Adam story.
He says, back in July 2017, my dad was invited by Nicholas Prom to record a Comic Reflections podcast talking about the first DeHarlow story in JLA number 130. Unfortunately, personal and work commitments got in the way of their scheduling, and the podcast was never recorded, but I did find Dad's notes for the show, which include notes on the Adam story as well. And then we got a look inside the brilliant mind of Zoom Yukinori. Yeah. It's too much to read all of it here, but again, Isamu posted the synopsis for JLA 130, his notes on that issue, which included his dismay at the Justice League fighting and imprisoning a pregnant alien. Zoom went on to mention the Atom in the story, concluding that after the Atom set the microscopic children free, quote, and this is Zoom, there was no mention of what happened to the original DeHarlow, who was erroneously shown in flashback fighting the JLA on Earth in the great outdoors instead of aboard the JLA satellite. So I presume she was still inside the computer and either died after spawning or was inevitably killed when the satellite was destroyed in the Justice League of America annual number 3. In either case, she died in captivity and was forced to spawn without going back home. Not a good look, Justice League. To put a cap on it, Martin Menza added that Isamu Justice League number 130 was one of my earliest DC comics. I remember the exact spinner rack I bought it from. This was the issue that had me hooked on the league, leading me to buy every issue going forward, including getting a subscription about a year or two later. So big happenings in Justice League number 130.
Next up, future guest and Patreon supporter of the show, Brian Schufo, says, I didn't have that issue of The Black Hole, but I did see the movie at my hometown's drive-in theater.
Really? Really? Did you, Brian?
I think he did. I think I'm the only one who had to lie, who felt they had to lie about it. I couldn't follow the story, but I do remember the two little flying robots, and one of them was completely beat up. I think there was a black hole somewhere. Those drive-in theaters always showed two movies, and I'm sure I was more interested in the first movie, which is probably something like Return from Witch Mountain. This is Sean speaking. I love the Witch Mountain movies, so that was great. And then back to Brian. Or The Apple Dumpling Gang Rides Again. The second movies were always something I had never heard of, which is how I ended up seeing Logan's Run, which made a huge impression on me as a little kid. It's a good thing my mom was asleep in the back seat. And then Bat DJ, and also future guest, Matthew Davis, says, the other day I noticed a carnival set up in the parking lot of a nearby mall. I would go, but knowing my luck, there would be a shadowy league in the area.
Well, as long as you get Nam Tabs cotton candy, you'll be all right.
Six stories? Man, this issue is bursting at the seams. Batman, musical choice, Bloodletting by Concrete Blonde. I have no idea about that song whatsoever.
I don't know that one.
It's always good to see Irv Novik's work. In my opinion, he tends to get overlooked. Interesting twist at the end, if not somewhat predictable these days. And after everything he's seen, Batman still dismisses things like vampires? Good catch on the subtext, Chris. I also wondered if Ivorn was waiting to kill himself until he could find someone like Batman who could help Moon. By the way, I'm really disappointed that all these straight guys are seeing this subtext that I completely missed. And this in Gay Pride Month? That's not fair. Tales of Gotham City. Folsom Prison Blues by Johnny Cash. Of course I know that
I've
song.
Heard that
that's
one.
Fantastic. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great song. Double the Novik goodness. It's also good to see Commissioner Gordon going diehard almost a decade before Bruce Willis. Robin and Batgirl reunited by Peaches and Herb. Of course I know that. Robin and Batgirl together again. Yay! With art by, well, hey, the Dynamite Duo are together again. I hope that that tape Barbara destroyed didn't have any other memories. And yeah, you're right. She probably relished the challenge of figuring out their real identities again. After what happened, I get how Robin felt. Although very out of character, I agree. But it's not exactly fair that they should know who she is, but she doesn't know who they are. The whole, if you knew my secret identity, you would be in danger argument seems odd at times, but especially in this case. Barbara was endangered because of her father, the police commissioner. Second, Theo originally planned to destroy the tapes. If Theo went through with his original plan, Barbara's memories would have been lost. The fact that she knew their secret IDs actually saved Barbara.
That's a good point. I didn't think
of that. Yeah, that's fantastic. The Atom, Welcome to the Machine by Pink Floyd. I have no idea. I don't know that song. Sorry. This feels like a story left over from the implosion. Not a bad story, but it would have been good to see the Atom do more than travel through phone lines. I do like the callback with the DeHarlow. Alfred, the Mr. Belvedere theme song. I am a huge fan of TV theme songs, so yes, I know that song. This was a fun story. Not only do we see Alfred defending his profession and proving his worth as Batman's trusted aide, but we get a call out to a fellow butler, Jarvis. They never did explain why Robin disguised himself as Alfred. Maybe they had a spare Alfred mask laying around and didn't realize a photographer managed to get a shot of Batman arresting Alfred. Batman, the second story. The theme song from 24. Oh my God, those first few seasons of 24. I loved that show. That was like nail-biting for me.
That was a good show.
You know how a TV series has a season-long storyline with different threads going in all directions that start to come together in the next-to-last episode, setting everything up for the finale? That's what this story felt like. Nice little stunt of Batman's to use the swinging ride to get up to the roller coaster. I'd go to the carnival and try that, but every day I'm feeling less like Riggs and more like Murtaugh. That's a great reference.
Next up, Rob McCarthy makes a quick drop by the reunion and adds, hey, Robin can't be that worried about his secret ID. He fights crime on a small campus where Dick Grayson also goes to school. Fair enough, Rob. And then network all-star and noted Floridian and film historian Rob Kelly had this to say. Great episode as usual. Chris talking Batman is second only to toys in terms of what I want out of a podcast. Great to have them together again on the show. This issue's cover is burned into my brain. I saw the house ad for it so many times, considering all the Rob, quote, Easter eggs, Alan Alda as Robin, a NamTab mention. I should have read it before now. I loved all the Irv Novik info. Hard to imagine someone wanting to get out of advertising and back into comics those days. Usually it was the other way around. Yeah. The toy car ad used to make me so mad. Another example of Aquaman missing out on merch in place of Captain Marvel. Grr. That said, Marvel's ride is so boss, by far the coolest of the bunch. I might need to check out prices on eBay. And the Atom is one of those utility players that DC would drop in different books when they had an extra few pages. He stars in a one-page story in World's Finest a few years after this, to which Chris Franklin says, if I remember right, that one-pager Atom story was drawn by Irv Novik. Thanks, guys.
Next up, our back cousin and past guest, Martin Gray. Ah, Martin Gray.
Here we go.
Had a few comments.
Sit tight, listeners.
Thanks for having me back to the barbecue. I've brought ham and peas pudding baps. I'm hoping you'll let me come next time if I should be so lucky. What a treat to have Chris back. I'm spinning around at the great goblets of arcane comics knowledge he always brings. Again, though, this isn't a classic issue. I have no idea why you keep sounding surprised that these stories were never reprinted. Mind, it's never too late. That cover is burned into my mind. Ross Andrew was so good. On the question of why Ross draws the Don Heck Batgirl collar, he did it especially for you. Nah, it's to match the Don Heck interior art. As regards to the actual story, yep, it's stupid and insulting. Pure super dick dickery. I don't know if anyone is in touch with Jack C. Harris, but can't you use your Bob Razakis signal to find out why Barbara had to forget the secret identities? Maybe we can, though. No prize Babs never mourning Kathy Kane by assuming her memories of Batwoman were on that lost tape. So this is Sean now. I think that is a fantastic.
I like that idea too.
Yeah, I love that. But then Martin says, no, I'll come up with something better if you give me just a little more time. Thinking on, surely the next time Robin and Batman join Superman for an issue of World's Finest, good old Alfred would invite Babs round to Wayne Manor for afternoon tea and remind her of their secret identities. I mean, he would not stand the unfairness of it all. I agree. The Batgirl and Robin title logos weren't awful. At least they don't have their stupid heads, but they're not keepers. That Adam classic, now that's a masthead. I wouldn't change a thing. The Adam story itself, though, was not great. Well done, Chris, for the most entertaining and effective detective work this issue, working out why the heck that strip was in here. I'd not be surprised had three pages been culled from it. A Gene Loring or Enrichetta Negrini scene, maybe?
She was the Adams Ray Palmer lab assistant.
Oh, okay. I love the name Negrini. I mean, eight pages was the standard for Adams shorts, and this is terribly terse at just five. I wouldn't not say, I've got to be certain, but the speculation is appreciated. Oh dear, in the comic book roundup, as you step back in time, I hear Chris talking about the nude adventures of Superboy.
There is something Sean would really pick up.
The Alfred logo is okay, and he certainly stars in the best story in the book. Also, that crook with the frilly shirt was all kinds of hot. What do I have to do to look that dapper? Tales of Gordon, Gotham City was also pretty decent. I'm glad the commish was okay. If he died, there'd be tears on my pillow. And make no mistake, two Batman stories again. What a wasted opportunity. Surely someone has the great Aunt Harriet novelette waiting to be printed. The vampire tale was the best. Such sad stuff. The first time I ever read the ending, I was shocked by the power of love. As for the interminable League of Assassins nonsense, I couldn't be arsed to reread it. The art is lovely, though. Hand on your heart. Boys, are you enjoying this serial? Finishing up, Martin adds, thank you for the couple of shout-outs, especially as regards Wonder Woman and the Twinkies. And yes, spot on, those cakes would not have suffered so far as taste is concerned. Honestly, you would get a more enjoyable meal from a styrofoam bat plane. Mind, then the plane would lose its locomotion. Catch you next month for more greatest hits. Well, Martin, let me tell you, reading your message made my heart go, put'em, put'em. Now, normally we do a Richie Rich count, but this time I get to do a Kylie Minogue count because Martin peppered in 13 song titles. So that was fantastic. I'm laying down the gauntlet. If anyone else wants to pepper their comments with Pet Shop Boys or George Michael song titles, you get to hear me singing as horribly as I did through Martin's.
Please, listeners, don't do it. Moving on, we get a couple of side conversations. One regarding the Atom's weight-shifting ability that Rob McCarthy, Martin, Siskoid, and Isamu all contributed to. Yeah. And then another when Rob McCarthy once again lamented that we get Atom and the Demon, but no Joker stories in the Batman family. Check out the websites if you want to hear what they had to say on these topics. Next up, our Bat Cousin and past guest, Tim Price, wanted to add his comments. Hey, Bat Cousins, your friendly neighborhood outsider here. Hope you don't mind. I have some thoughts on a recurring point in this show. Batman not accepting the supernatural. Has Batman encountered ghosts, vampires, aliens, etc.? Absolutely. But at his heart, he's a detective and thus a skeptic, not taking things at face value, because he's also encountered in equal amounts con men, frauds, wannabes, and the outright delusional. Batman needs to confirm the facts first because it changes how he fights them. Using holy water and garlic on a real vampire? Very effective. But on a wacko who's actually human? Not so much. After all, just look at the earlier Roy Raymond story. Three fake aliens, and the only real alien was Hawkgirl in disguise. In this issue, one fake vampire and one real vampire. So I don't take Batman's disbelief as a bug, it's a feature. Yes, it's funny to tease how the writing makes it sound like Batman's forgetting the actual aliens and magicians he knows, but I just wanted to acknowledge that by and large, his intention to find the truth is reasonable. That is way more intelligent and serious discussion than we've ever had on the topic.
Right.
Well done, Tim.
I like that a lot. But I think if Tim were writing the story, Tim would have Batman say, I know a real vampire, so I need to figure out if this is a...
9 out of 10 vampires aren't really vampires. Right, so I'm, yeah. I'm not going to believe it till I prove it.
Tim's version is his idea is fantastic.
Yeah, love it. Thank you, Tim. That was a great point. Tim leaves us with... And on a different note, Lord was Robin a jerk to Batgirl. That story merited being lost in a reboot and a retcon, which it was not that long later.
Yeah.
Anyway, great show as always. Till next time. Thank you very much, Tim. And still not content to be done, Isamu comes back yet again to tell us that I neglected to mention that my dad had a copy of that Superman 2 movie special, which is a 20-page, 12-inch by 9-inch program, much as you described, Uncle Chris. Isamu then posted a bunch of awesome pictures from the magazine. Again, yeah. If you do nothing else this month, pilgrims, go check out the website.
Yeah.
Got a lot of great stuff on it. Next up, we got Lizanne Oswald. Cool episode as always. I almost didn't give feedback this week. How can I annoy the world and point out terrible fashion mistakes if I miss a week? That's a great cover of Robin and Baz, but oi, those two at odds is not good. That would be a scary War of the Roses. The criminals might sleep easier if it happens, because although Babs dresses sometimes like Stevie Wonder is her fashion consultant, she is very smart and clever. No argument from us, Lizanne.
And finally, one of our guests from this very episode, Brett Young, just had to get in the last word. Hey, Bat Cousins, sorry I'm late. I baked cookies, but put them in the Tupperware container without parchment paper to separate the layers, so now it's actually one giant horrific cookie. Enjoy! While the Batman vampire story was silly, I'm a big fan of Irv Novik. Paul, thanks for the terrific Bat History lesson on Novik. Novik isn't included in most lists of superstar artists, but he was a great draftsman with solid storytelling ability. and got the job done every time. And his look was so indicative of the time. The comic book artist version of an episode of The Rockford Files. You could practically smell the aftershave on the pages. Plus, it sounds like he was not only a reliable and talented artist, but also a good dude. The Commissioner Gordon story was good. Novick had Gordon at his Barney Millerist. He's a character who has evolved for the better over the years, so it was cool seeing him get some solo action so early on. Great seeing Batgirl and Robin together again, even under these ridiculous circumstances. Brilliant idea Robin had to pull Barbara's Batgirl mask out of her purse to jog her memory. Apparently Babs hadn't opened her purse in a month, or she may have figured it out herself. Does she not pay for things? And oh no, that evil scientist that they had tied helplessly to a light post and was ready to expose all of Robin and Batgirl's secrets got accidentally shot by the gunman whose arm Batgirl accidentally pulled in his exact direction. What were the odds? Better burn that tape too. Once again, can't say enough about Don Newton's art on the last Batman story, especially the carnival scene. The construct Batman jumps on to get momentum reminds me of a ride my daughter talked me into riding last year called Speed XXL at Myrtle Beach's Broadway at the Beach. You are strapped into an open air chair and then spun around at a speed of over 50 miles per hour, all while spinning on an axis that takes you up to 130 feet, basically the height of a 10-story building. I remember opening my eyes at one point when I was upside down and all I could see was sky. My daughter thought it was the greatest ride ever. I think I threw up my heart. Well, gotta run. Looking forward to next episode's guest. Oh no, this guy again? Now we're gonna acknowledge all of our Bat family members who shared our podcast on social media. We appreciate all of the support from the entire community. On Facebook, we got likes and forwards and all of that kind of stuff from Chris Franklin, Tom Pincinault, Brett Young, Max Romero, Mike Thomas, Terry O'Malley, Alan E. Boyce Jr., Magazines and Monsters, Jay Campbell, Joey Hines, Tim Price, Matthew Davis, Harold Wallen, Jack Dower, Paul Wildenberger, James Williams, Scott Rowland, Dan Jackson, A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast, and Don Lindbergh. On Twitter, we got retweets and likes from Scott X, Jim Ball, Isamu, Steve Whitbread, Paul Wildenberger, Chris, Dr. Gordon B. Schmidt, Rodney Trainum, Martin Gray, Sean, but not me, Sean, it's Sean at SEANRT72, Dr. Pop Culture, Willie Yarber, Relatively Geeky Podcast Network, Coffee and Comics, Liz Ann Oswald, Irredeemable Shag, Firestorm Fan, and then finally, it's someone who has the three astrological symbols, but I don't know what they are because I'm not up on my astrology. But their at is at Ask Annie, A-N-I, Sun, S-O-N, 22. So thanks for all of that. On Facebook, we had a nice few messages from Joey Hines, who said, love this show and the material being covered. Tom Pincinault said, great episode all. Really enjoyed all the Irv Novick love. One of the negatives about being an aging fan is mentioning talent like Irv and many others to other younger fans and just being met with blank stares. Yeah. You guys have no idea how much I appreciate you all.
Oh, that's very kind.
I'm off to hunt down that copy of Back Issue. Until next month, cousins. And then Paul replied, thanks, Tom, you made my day.
You did make my day that day, yes.
Don Lindbergh said he was loving the podcast, so thank you for that very much. Heading over to Twitter on the Bat Fam Reunion Twitter handle, Rodney Trainum said, a great way to start the month is a new episode of the Batman Family Reunion. I remember this cover from an old ad and thinking, what is Robin doing to Batgirl? I've got this issue on the to-read pile and hope to comment on the issue soon. Overall, this was a fun issue. I enjoyed the second Batman story, but the first felt rushed. I did pick up the gay vibes between Moon and Ivorn as well. Come on! Then he goes on to say, I think Batgirl should be trusted with a dynamic duo's identities, so I disliked the ending of the Batgirl-Robin story. Amen, cousin. Amen.
That's great. Well, thank you, everybody, for all those comments and engagement. We love it. But before we go, as most of you know, Running the Fire and Water Network has gotten more and more costly over the years as more shows were added. So if you're enjoying what you hear on this show or any of our other shows, please consider becoming a patron. At certain levels, you can get a call out on the show of your choice And our special thanks go out to our Bat cousin and future guest, Brian Schufo, who asked to be named on the Batman Family Reunion. Thanks again, Brian. Remember, we're not all Bruce Wayne, but any small amount you can give helps defray the cost, and we promise that none of the money will go towards buying answers to college exams. To find out how, go to patreon.com/FWpodcasts. And thanks.
That will do it for the feedback section and for episode 490. Thanks again to our special guests, Brett Young and Siskoid. As always, it is a blast to record with them. Thank you for listening, and we hope you will join us next month as Batman faces off once again against Maxi Zeus and we get the assassination of Batgirl.